The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Reporters overreact to Donald Trump removing his mask.
It's like something out of North Korea. The dear leader comes out, right, with the magnificent helicopter entrance and up the stairs and off goes the mask as he pauses.
This was after they claim he put the Secret Service in jeopardy.
Where do you think the rest of the agents are when he's inside the hospital? Do you think they're at home?
It all boils down to freedom.
Do you want a country that engages in safetyism or a country that embraces liberty?
And fear.
It's absolutely astounding to watch.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. Follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt and follow the program as well at Town Hall Review. When the week began, President Donald Trump was in Walter Reed Medical Center, where he spent the weekend with COVID-19. 3 days earlier, he had announced that he and First Lady Melania had the coronavirus. When the president left for the hospital, rumors began swirling. Many suggested things were much worse than the president and his staff let on. Some said he might not make it out alive. They were already discussing how to hold an election with the deceased president. But over the weekend, he addressed the nation from the hospital. And the president was strong, all things considered. When he returned home on Monday and again spoke to the nation, it was clear that he avoided the worst, especially in light of the risk factors due to his age. Still, the Democrats in the Senate saw this as perhaps their last hope to derail the Supreme Court nomination of the highly qualified Amy Coney Barrett. I discussed the effort with Senator Marco Rubio on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Senator, the other thing I want to talk about is Amy Coney Barrett. I have a column in the Washington Post that Mitch McConnell is the indispensable man because of the great quartet, holding open the Scalia seat, breaking the filibuster on Neil Gorsuch, standing by Brett Kavanaugh, and assuring a vote for Amy Coney Barrett. I think that saves the United States Constitution, along with the 53 appeals court judges, for the next generation of law. What do you make of my premise?
No, I think it's right. I mean, look, the bottom line is the courts are incredibly important. And here's the thing. Mitch McConnell has done what Chuck Schumer would do if he was the majority leader. He would do all those tactics. The only difference between us doing it and them doing it is you wouldn't have three or four major networks going crazy as if you're somehow violating the law or doing something. There's no constitutional or legal question here. None. Zero. Zip. But they pretend like there is. But that's the only difference. And in the end, if Amy Coney Barrett was a liberal in people's minds and on the media's minds, right now, I mean, she would be on the cover of Vogue. They'd already been making a movie about her. You know, there all kinds of stuff would be going on about how great she is and so forth. But look, it is what it is. We're going to do what we know is right. We know that there are millions of people in this country that feel the same way and don't care about what other people are saying. She's highly qualified. No one disputes that. She'll have her hearing. We'll see how that goes. And then obviously, you know, there'll be a vote on the floor. And assuming everything is the way I expect it to be with her, given what I know about her and have known about her for the better part of 3 years, I anticipate that she is going to be confirmed. And then the Senate and then the president will appoint her and she'll take her seat on the bench.
The buzz among the conference, as you talk to your colleagues, will that happen before the election?
Well, if the plan is to have the hearing next week in Judiciary and then a vote the following week and then in the committee and then off, obviously a week after that, the Senate would come in and confirm it. And that's the plan. Obviously, you know, things can change because you just don't know what the next few weeks will bring. But that's the plan. And whether it's before or shortly after, I anticipate it'll be before.
Now, you have a lot of colleagues who are on the ballot. You are not yourself running. Susan Collins in Maine, who I think may have the greatest influence of the Senate of anybody and certainly a lot of courage. David Perdue in Georgia, Tom Tillis in North Carolina, Cory Gardner in Colorado, Martha McSally in Arizona, Joni Ernst in Iowa, and, of course, Steve Daines in Montana. How do you feel about holding the Senate right now?
Well, it's going to be a battle. Each state has got its own different dynamic. you know. And in Georgia, we have two Senate races, including Kelly Loeffler, who's going to end up, you know, in a sort of a scrambled runoff in January. So that one really has got a different structure to it. But these are all great candidates. They're the only people on the planet that have a chance of winning as a Republican. They're all great senators. I mean, really, it's one of these weird things where all these really good senators happen to be on the ballot in a contentious year. They're being outraised, not even though they're raising more than Republicans ever have. You know, the left has mobilized these $5, $10, $15, $20 checks that are not coming from the center. I mean, they're coming from radical left of center groups who have an agenda that they think they can carry out. So, but I think they're all working very hard, and I feel, you know, cautiously optimistic about our chance to win each one, because each one of these races has its unique dynamics, and we've got great candidates in every single one of them with a great story to tell about what they've done in their time in the Senate.
In this new book, The Heart of a Great Nation, which is the quotes and the essays and the quips of Ronald Reagan, you write in the foreword, "I think Reagan would join me, Marco Rubio, in believing that the biggest threat to America's values today is our national divisiveness. Senator, I have never seen anything like this weekend. And when the president returned to the White House, if I could play for you just a couple of quick clips, cut number 9, Aaron Burnett on CNN.
So let me start with you, Dr. Reiner. What we're seeing here really looks like it's like something out of North Korea. The dear leader comes out, right, with the magnificent helicopter entrance and up the stairs and off goes the mask as he pauses.
Then, you know, I want to go to number 10, Jim Acosta at CNN.
Oh, that's right, Wolf. They'll try to ask him some questions as he comes into the White House. But keep in mind, this is not just the president returning to the White House. This may be patient zero. This is the virus coming back to the White House. And I will tell you, Wolf, having been here.
Now I want to go to cut number 11, Joy Reid on MSNBC.
This is a Mussolini moment. Donald Trump.
Now I want to go to cut number 12, Chris Cuomo on CNN.
He didn't just walk into the White House one time with no mask tonight. He had his video crew capture that stupid scene again so he could put out propaganda, fronting a lie to his people. Once again, just like, don't worry about the mask. Now he says, don't worry about COVID. Don't let it control your life. Just propaganda. That's all it is. I know this sound to it. I'm not going to play it for you. Why should I? How much bull do you need in your life?
All right, I'm going to play one more. Cut number 13, Don Lemon on CNN.
It was surprising to me that when this happened, that a lot of people said, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I don't believe he has COVID. I think he's faking it. I think he's going to do whatever he can to try to win the presidency. I am, you know, I'm not that cynical. I'm a cynic, but I'm not that cynical.
There's also no proof of him faking it, and the opposite
right.
seems to have the preponderance
of
the evidence.
There's no proof of any of it because he won't let the doctors give the information.
So Marco Rubio, that's a montage of clips, but it's representative of the weekend.
Yeah,
what?
Look, it Go speaks ahead. For itself, okay? I mean, people, to the extent they're watching, at this point, the country's become so segmented that the only people watching that are people that agree with them. I mean, that's just a fact. And the other thing they don't tell you, it's a lot of it's show business. I mean, this is about ratings. Simple as that. And these networks have figured out that, you know, you become crazy in one direction and you're gonna have an audience and you can charge advertisers for it. I mean, but it's doing great damage to journalism. I mean, what happens now is it doesn't matter what these networks report on anything. Half the people won't believe them because they think they're liars and they won't listen to them. So it leaves us vulnerable and ultimately leads to divisiveness. There's no news reporting really anymore. I mean, there is, I guess, but no one's really putting it out there. It's not getting all the attention. It's all about narratives. You establish a narrative. This is what I want the narrative to be. And then you collect facts that support your narrative. You ignore the ones that don't. And that's what you promote. And it leads to ratings. And you charge people for advertising. That's what all this is. It's show business. That's what cable news has turned into.
For more on that conversation, go to townhallreview.com. Many of you are familiar with Charlie Kirk, the young founder of Turning Point USA. He's also the newest host in the Salem chain. He brings his perspective on Trump's return to the White House on Monday.
What the president is portraying by taking his mask off when he gets back to the Truman balcony to give this grand return to the White House is that everything is fine. And as he said, don't let coronavirus control your life. But that is very much still a president who has coronavirus.
I think that was Caitlin Collins from CNN. Caitlin Collins, who takes off her mask immediately as soon as President Trump leaves the briefing room. And there's a great picture of Caitlin Collins. As soon as the press briefings are over, the mask goes off for Caitlin Collins. So Caitlin Collins is reminding people, just so you know, he got a different level of care. Well, he is the president. He also has a different level of transportation than you do, Caitlin Collins. He is the president, okay? I don't know how many Americans have a 757 double-decker private jet that can just cart around the country. He also has a different level of security, too. That's called the Secret Service. He's the president of the United States. Of course he's going to have higher level care. Just trying to remind people. I just want you to know that he's getting a higher level of treatment. Well, I would hope so. I would hope so that the president wouldn't have to check into some sort of line at a community hospital and just say, you're on your own, President Trump. There's an unbelievable article by my friend Heather McDonald, and it's called Against Fear. There is more wisdom in this article than almost any of the activist media has been portraying in the last decade. President Trump's handling of his coronavirus diagnosis models, positive masculinity, rational and unbowed. I mean, that alone is enough to have the activist media dismiss this piece altogether. She says, and she argues, the media and the democratic establishments are in a frenzy of Schadenfreude. What a wonderful German name. It means pleasure derived from another's misfortune. Over President Trump's Chinese coronavirus diagnosis. Trump's contracting the disease, they argue, discredits any coronavirus policy short of lockdowns and mandatory mask wearing, outdoors as well as in. Trump is now exhibit number one for the failure of his leadership on the coronavirus, Democratic pollster Jeff Garin told the New York Times. She continues in the piece by saying this, yet such displays of coronavirus virtue signaling will now multiply exponentially, especially from the mass television reporters speaking en plein air to a camera yards away. Just like Nancy Pelosi, who does all of her press conferences now wearing a mask. Can't understand a word she's saying. Had difficulty beforehand. Now it's extra difficult to understand what she's saying. And so then Heather continues by making the argument that the overindulgence of mask wearing and the culture of fear is impacting our children. Heather argues children are being inculcated into a culture of fear. She's exactly right. 6, 7, and 8-year-olds are being forced to wear masks to the grocery store, to elementary school. She continues by saying, there is a real risk in being cavalier. The president is an embodiment of that. She is quoting Frank Bruni. But of course there's a risk in being cavalier. That's an obvious presupposition. But the question is this. Do you want a country that engages in safetyism or a country that embraces liberty? One of the best sentences in this entire article says, making policies based on Trump's recent infection would ironically replicate the media's own decried narcissism. The validity of any given policy choice that affects thousands must be judged based on averages, not individual cases. We could reduce coronavirus transmission to zero. It's true. By having mandatory prison-style lockdowns in a separate cell until a vaccine is developed.
Coming up, more on the media meltdown over the return of President Donald Trump.
It's absolutely astounding to watch.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. While the president was at the Walter Reed Medical Center, a large group of Trump supporters gathered near the hospital, waving flags and encouraging the commander-in-chief. The scene touched Donald Trump. So he got in his motorcade and rode by the well-wishers to greet them. He was inside his car with his mask on, with his windows closed, waving his hand to his supporters. You'd think this would be viewed as a kind gesture on the part of the sitting president. Not when it's this president. Not with this media. Here's Salem host Sebastian Gorka.
Don't be afraid of COVID. Don't let it dominate your life. We have developed under the Trump administration some really great drugs and knowledge. I feel better than I did 20 years ago. And you know what?
Now we have the serum. We're just going to give everybody President Trump's antibody serum, and then the left will truly go insane because this weekend was not enough. Suddenly, after months of them saying, oh, police are systematically racist, there's absolute violence in the police, they're using it to exploit their power to abuse others and to oppress them. Oh, but, oh no, the poor Secret Service agents. They're endangered by the president in his up-armored SUV. How could he get into a vehicle with them? You mean the same Secret Service agents that are actually, and this isn't, you can look it up, you can see the interviews with former agents, are trained to jump in the path of bullets. They're called, colloquially, the bullet catchers. Their job is to die for the president. It's part of the job description. You think they're worried about a little thing called the Chinese virus? Which, by the way, the agents in the vehicle who were in full PPE, they even had the gowns on, the medical gowns, were separated by the president by a Perspex screen that's built into the vehicle. According to Dave Bossy, who I saw at Walter Reed and Corey Lewandowski, they were asked to volunteer for that assignment to drive the president down to see you, the people who have his back now that he's had ours for 4 years. Who wants to drive me down? Volunteers. And also, you morons in the legacy media, where do you think the rest of the agents are when he's inside the hospital? Do you think they're at home having a Miller Lite? I mean, seriously, their job is to be right next to the principal, the president, 24/7. And now you care about them? Jennifer Rubin, the mental case, I just tweeted it out and I got a lot of response. Could you imagine living with Jennifer Rubin, the fake conservative at the Washington Post? She freaks out. What was it? Was it Friday he went to Walter Reed? It feels like weeks ago, doesn't it? Incredible. She's freaking out. Oh my gosh, why does he take Marine One? Why does he fly to Walter Reed instead of going by car? How dare he drive in that vehicle endangering the Secret Service agents? You're a moron. Or you think your audience are idiots. Or maybe both.
Imagine the media concern if Obama, while in the White House, contracted a potentially deadly disease. Imagine the media swoon if, days later, he returned to the White House and addressed them, healthy, from the balcony. Instead, media anchors appeared almost angry that Trump had done so well, angry that he had modeled a calm courage in the face of this pandemic.
I made it through about 20 minutes of Fox News Sunday, and I couldn't do it anymore. It's my job to watch the Sunday morning news shows. I'm going to give you a heads up. I may not watch another one through the election. Here was Chris going really hard at Steve Cortez on Fox News Sunday yesterday.
Steve, let's talk about reasonable risk, because there was the debate on Tuesday night, as you say, that I moderated. The rules from the Cleveland Clinic could not have been more clear. Everyone in the audience was to wear a mask. The president and the former vice president and I were the only ones exempt from that. We've got a picture up on the screen. After the first family came in, they all took off their masks. So did the White House chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Do they think that the health and safety rules for everybody else do not apply to them?
No, that's not the reality. Look, everybody was tested before that event, as you well know. Those of us who went first were tested by Cleveland Clinic directly. Everybody who gets on Air Force One for any trip on Air Force One is tested before they get on.
Steve, it doesn't matter. Everybody that was in that room was tested. Everybody that was in that room was tested, and the Cleveland Clinic's regulation was it didn't matter. Everybody except for the three of us on the stage was to wear a mask, and people from the Cleveland Clinic came over and offered the first family masks, thinking maybe they didn't have them. They were waved away, and the Commission on Presidential Debates has issued a statement saying, from now on, if you don't wear a mask, you're going to be escorted from the hall.
I mean, Chris is clearly upset, clearly angry. I watched in utter amazement as Chris Wallace had just a complete meltdown with Steve Cortez, president's campaign spokesman. they got into it so badly, and I thought Chris was just going to start cursing him out. I thought maybe he's just going to tell him, well, your mama wears combat boots. Start yelling at him. If they were in studio, I think they'd have been rolling around on the floor together. I mean, did you see that? And finally, Chris Cortez, after getting harangued and harangued and harangued, after all of the Chris going at him, and finally, Steve just turned around and said, all right, you're going to go there? Let's go there.
The Chris, rule. I was there. Those chairs were not close together. Look, those chairs were not close together. And again, we also believe that people.
It doesn't matter, Steve. The rules from the Cleveland Clinic were close together, Steve. And the rules from the Cleveland Clinic were everybody wears a mask. Why didn't
Chris? Chris, the way you're starting to harangue me now actually reminds me of what you did to the president during that debate on Tuesday night when
he harangued him.
No, and he had to debate not just Joe Biden, but you as well. You were not a neutral moderator then. I don't mind tough questions. I welcome reasonably tough questions, but what I don't think is okay is for you to become the effective opposition to the president. Okay? And everyone there was tested in the crowd. They were distanced from each other. People can make reasonable decisions for themselves.
No, they can't. They're the rules, and they'll be kicked out next time. Steve, let me just simply say the president interrupted me and the vice president 145 times, so I object to saying I harangued the president. I know it's the talking point.
Well, Chris, I guess you showed him. You expect that from others who have acted that way, you know, Morning Joe and all the others that hate this president and have always hated him. To watch that? Maybe you didn't see it. He's literally wagging his finger at Steve Cortez. He's taking his finger and he's pointing at him at the camera. I think Chris Wallace thinks that was good journalism. I think these guys, Jake Tapper, all of them that are literally, it's like Howard Beale from Network. Remember that movie? I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Well, Chris had his Howard Beale moment. Jake Tapper had his Howard Beale moment. I don't even want to play Jake Tapper. He's so nasty and over the top. These folks aren't journalists anymore. They're not even close. And Chris Wallace claims that the president interrupted him. He was the moderator. How many times do you suppose Chris Wallace interrupted the president? Or how many times do you think Biden interrupted the president? But that doesn't count, right? Because, you know, orange man bad. Orange man bad. Coming up.
It's really going to cast a broader doubt on our election system.
The mass voting by mail. The town hall review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The election is less than a month away, and already there is trouble as people have started with early voting. A number of states are tied up with lawsuits as some Democrats seek to lengthen the time frame for votes to be counted. It's difficult to imagine an election where the outcome in numerous states could come weeks after Election Day. Pete Peterson, dean of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, reviewed the issues currently hampering the system. He joined Salem's Chris Stegall on 990 The Answer out of Philadelphia.
Pete, I don't worry about Biden-Trump head-to-head. I try awfully hard to not be hysterical or needlessly push conspiracy theories where I don't think it's necessary. It's hard to not see that there is a movement in this country that is eager to sow the seeds of mistrust in our system. And Democrats seem to continue to want to move, change, make how you vote, where you vote, the days you can vote, the deadline to vote. They want to make all that malleable and pliable when we've had this very perfectly working system for a long time. Request an absentee ballot if you can't be there in person. Vote on election day, and that's that. They want to make it so much more complex with no identifiers. Everybody gets a ballot. Push ballots out en masse. Move election day. Count votes 3 and 4 days after the election. And, Pete, how in the world does that not instill a sense of dread in a lot of American voters about the integrity of things?
Well, it's hard not to, Chris. And, of course, I'm coming to you live here from the national capital of making it easy to vote, right? I mean, we have a system here that not only has these voting centers, it is going to full mass vote by mail for this forthcoming election. We have legal ballot harvesting here in the state, and the governor has just issued by executive order the ability for ballots to be counted a full 17 days after Election Day.
Yes.
So you're absolutely right about the partisan nature of these so-called reforms. I would say in the defense of those, and I know so many on the center-left were in so-called election reform that push for these things, I think many of them are well-intentioned. I would just say that they set themselves up for providing an environment where, A, fraud can happen, but B, Chris, I have to say, we are going to see stories around the country of election systems, whether at the county level or the state level, just being overwhelmed by the amount of regulations that have been opened up to make it easier to vote. And I'm afraid that we're going to see so many stories of, you know, shelves, trays of ballots being left in garbage cans and in the backs of postal service trucks, that it's really going to cast a broader doubt on our election system.
And Pete Peterson, Dean of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, you guys have been doing this for, like you said, a while in California. It's new to us in Pennsylvania. In New Jersey, they're even more aggressive about it. In Pennsylvania, you at least have to request a mail-in ballot. In New Jersey, they're doing what you guys, I think, in California do, which is just everybody gets a ballot. They're just airdropped. You know, whether you've lived in a resident for 30 years or not, you get a ballot.
We also have automatic voter registration, right? So you don't even, when you get your license, you basically click a box and you're going to get an election registration form in the mail. You're going to be automatically registered here. So, yeah, I mean, on a whole array of measures, we make it easy to vote.
But see, Pete, the disingenuous argument is always, well, what is it you and Pete have such a problem with making it easy to vote? Why do you want to make it so hard to vote, they'll say, which is a disingenuous argument. But how do you answer it?
Well, I'd say that because there needs to be a certain level of responsibility on the part of the voter to vote, right? B, many of these measures are really only working on the margins. It's not like by pushing the ballot reception date back, say, 17 days as we do in California, it's going to enable millions of more votes to be cast. I mean, we have an election day for a reason, right? At the same time, I think it does open up the possibility, certainly with ballot harvesting, for fraud to happen. And I think these are issues that we all should be concerned about. As you said, our election system across the country has run fairly cleanly and well with a certain set of preconditions for decades. And so with all these recent changes being made, certainly some of them are being done in response to COVID, but some of them are just really so crazy. And again, I fear that for election systems, whether at the state or county level, that have not been used to working with these new regulations, we are going to see administrative failures that are going to cast doubt on the entire system. I mean, the very prospect that we could have one election result on Election Day, but the possibility of a different one two or three weeks later, I think really is going to be something that as Americans we need to be very concerned about.
Coming up, the difference between this pandemic and that which ravaged the country in 1918.
Indiscriminately, people died. Children, adolescents, young adults, as much as old adults.
Dennis Prager, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The prolonged shutdown of the states, mostly Democratic-controlled states, has devastated their economies. In states where shutdowns were limited, or, in the case of South Dakota, non-existent, businesses were able to survive and some are now thriving.
In California and New York, the economic impact is crippling. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager lives in California, more specifically Los Angeles County, where the far-left rules and many small businesses have been shuttered for months. Many have simply given up. Here's Dennis.
So the challenge to me and to those who agree with the president, not to be preoccupied, is the question of excess death. And it is approximately, thus far this year, 200,000 from everything I could see. And as people have written, if you don't attribute it to COVID-19, to what do you attribute it? So that's a very fair question. They're not dying of avalanche or of increased pancreatic cancer. So what else is there? As I understand it, and there's no subject that I have studied more as I have this, what it primarily does, at least in Europe and the United States, is it kills people who have very compromised immune systems owing to some pre-existing condition and old age. I mean, really old age. So that combination is quite often lethal. That means, if that is correct, that many of the people who died from COVID would have died of something else within a relatively short period of time, the outer limit being a year. So if most of the people, I can't prove this, but this is based on the age and comorbidity data that I have seen. If most of the people who have died basically died a year or less prematurely, which is why you have so many deaths in nursing homes, for example, then what we should expect is a lower excess mortality rate next year or the year after. So you can't only take the excess mortality rate of 1 year. If overwhelmingly the people who have died from it would have died within a circumscribed period of time, and I'm giving it a year, then that's not quite the same as, for example, the pandemic, the Spanish flu of 100 years ago, where indiscriminately people died, children, adolescents, young adults, as much as old adults. So that argues for isolating the elderly or those with compromised immune systems. Certainly argues for taking a prophylactic medication like hydroxychloroquine, one of the safest medications known to man. I have very little doubt that this will be proven to be true. We have crushed the livelihoods of millions of people for no good reason, that I still cannot eat as of this date, October 6th, 2020, inside a restaurant in Southern California, or at least in the Los Angeles area, is beyond belief. The callousness to little businesses that stores cannot be open. Nail salons have to still do their work outdoors. And by the way, there is also an element, just as there is, we know that more people die who drive motorcycles than drive cars. We don't ban motorcycles. In a free society, you allow people to do dangerous things. That is the way it works. That's what freedom is. Freedom has costs. You have a choice in life. No risks. Play it safe or be free. So I like a mixture of the two. I play it safe and free. I want to be free. If I don't want to go inside a restaurant, nobody's forcing me. But who the hell is Gavin Newsom or Eric Garcetti to tell me I can't? And I mean it. Who the hell are they? I don't understand it. And if they could do this for this, what can't they do it for? I wrote a column months ago, Dress Rehearsal for a Police State. And I am the last of the conspiracy believers. And I don't believe it's a conspiracy, but it happens to be a dress rehearsal for a police state. Somebody called from somewhere, I don't remember from where, to tell me that it is selfish to go and want to sit in a restaurant because you have to protect others' lives. It saves lives not to go into a restaurant. I know a lot of people think that. I think that it's selfish to crush people's businesses that they have spent their lives working for and working at. It's selfish to raise the speed limit. Every time we raise the speed limit, we know that more people will die on the roads. This notion that you live a life where rendering it almost impossible for others to die except by causes that cannot be affected, I don't understand living like that. If you feel that contact with strangers will kill you, stay home. Nobody's forcing you to leave your house, but people are forcing people to stay in their homes. That's the issue that we have. I feel sorry for people who've done that. I particularly feel sorry for the kids who haven't played with kids in half a year. If I told you that a certain family did not allow its children to play with other children for half a year, you would call Child Protective Services, wouldn't you? Because you would say that those parents had abused that child. It is a form of child abuse not to allow children to play with other children. In the name of safety, we are engaged in child abuse. Cowards call teachers, walk around with signs, "I didn't sign up to be a martyr." You certainly didn't, that's clear. You didn't even sign up to be a brave adult model for children. You signed up to be a coward. If you think you'll die from COVID teaching children, you're an idiot and a coward. That's a bad combo.
Coming up.
I disavowed then. I disavowed today on ABC with George Stephanopoulos. I disavowed again.
Trump again faces the same question when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed and Roe v. Wade is overturned, Joe Biden makes a commitment.
Making Roe the law of the land. That's what I would do.
We'll hear from Albert Mueller.
He would send to Congress a bill that would codify Roe v. Wade as national legislation.
Biden and the left are also talking about packing the court.
If the courts are political, you can't trust that you're going to get blind justice.
They'll look at the state of churches and nonprofits in the pandemic.
Givers have responded and said, you know, look, we want to continue to support the great work of ministries during these times.
And the critical role of pastors in the midst of it all.
We want to hold your arms up, Pastor.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. At the first debate between President Trump and Joe Biden, Donald Trump was once again asked to condemn white supremacy. It's a question that's been asked of him over a dozen times, and every time he's on record saying the same thing as you will hear in a moment. But when he ran past the question during the debate, the media treated it as if he'd never answered the question before. Here's Larry Elder.
President Trump, as you know, has been accused of saying that there were very fine people on both sides in reference to what happened in Charlottesville. And he's also been accused of never having denounced white supremacy, never having denounced David Duke.
David Duke just joined. A bigot, a racist, a problem.
Would you repudiate David Duke?
Sure.
David Duke and robocalls are out again. The white supremacist movement supporting you. Do you have any words for that?
Well, I disavow. David Duke endorsed me? Okay. All right. I disavow. Okay.
When we looked at it and looked at the question, I disavowed David Duke. So I've disavowed David Duke all weekend long on Facebook, on Twitter, and obviously it's never enough.
So are you prepared right now to make a clear and unequivocal statement renouncing the support of all white supremacists?
course I am. Of course I am.
When Chris joined, we had a news conference, and they asked me the exact same question. I said, I disavow. I disavowed then. I disavowed today on ABC with George Stephanopoulos. I disavowed again.
David Duke is a bad person who I disavowed on numerous occasions over the years.
I totally disavow the Ku Klux Klan. I totally disavow David Duke. Ultimately, he got to the Ku Klux Klan, which obviously I'm going to disavow.
I reject David Duke, rejected David Duke. I've rejected the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan.
But David Duke is saying to his supporters and followers, vote for Donald Trump. White supremacists are saying, vote. Do you want those votes?
No, I don't want them, and I don't want him to say it.
And you don't want the supporters?
No, I don't want anything.
What do you think of white supremacists, by the way?
I don't like any group of hate.
How many times does a man have to say this? A Connecticut sports anchor has been fired. Emmy-nominated Connecticut sports anchor. His name is Fred Gertney, and he was fired, quote, as a result of a racially insensitive comment, end of quote, referring to a tweet from the reporter earlier in which the reporter said, quote, thanks, Uncle Tom, close quote, referring to Tim Scott, the South Carolina senator. In announcing his removal, the TV station News 12 Connecticut said, quote, it has a zero tolerance policy for racism or improper conduct based on race and prides itself on being an objective and unbiased multi-platform news company, end of quote. He has since deleted his Twitter account. He issued an apology. But Don Lemon, who referred to Kanye West as putting on a minstrel show, not a problem.
Listen, I have no animosity for Kanye West. I'm just going to be honest, and I may get in a lot of trouble for it. I actually feel bad for him. What I saw was a minstrel show today.
Now, do you think if this white guy made the same comment that he just now made, Don Lemon referring to Kanye West as engaging in a minstrel show, he'd have been fired? Yeah, he'd have been fired.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of all the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posey, and Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, Harley Eady, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Thank you for joining us.